Nemoto presents addiction, the void and the brain. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 26 minutes. Addiction's psychological core can be described as a search for relief that gradually hardens into routine, identity, and necessity. At the beginning, a substance or behavior reduces tension, numbs pain, or delivers focus and energy. The effect feels useful, even rational. Over time, the same tool displaces other tools, demands more attention, and pushes aside relationships, work, health, and self-respect. What starts as compensation for a deficit becomes a central organizing principle. The deficit, the inner void, was present long before the first intoxication or the first compulsive act. The void may have been formed by neglect, humiliation, uncertainty, grief, or chronic stress. Addiction exploits that opening. Understanding this psychological arc is essential because without it, treatment reduces to willpower slogans, and relapse is misread as failure of character rather than failure of design. The term void denotes not melodrama but absence. Absence of safety in early caregiving, absence of reliable affirmation, absence of predictable boundaries, absence of belonging, absence of meaning. Many individuals who later struggle with addiction grew up in environments where signals were inconsistent. Praise alternated with criticism, attention with indifference, calm with volatility. In such conditions, the nervous system learned vigilance rather than rest. Pleasure and comfort arrived unpredictably, often with strings attached. Later in life, quick relief acquired unusual value. A drink that silenced intrusive memories, a pill that softened panic, a gamble that replaced numbness with intensity, each offered a shortcut to states that ought to have been available in ordinary life. The shortcut worked at first. The brain learned quickly. The rest followed predictably. Self-medication is an accurate phrase for many cases. A person with persistent anxiety experiences the immediate anxiolytic effects of alcohol and infers that anxiety has a simple fix. A person with depressive symptoms discovers that stimulants supply energy and focus that daily life withholds. A person with post-traumatic stress sleeps for the first time in weeks after taking an opioid and concludes that finally there is something that can silence the system. None of these inferences is absurd. Each aligns with a direct, observable effect. The trap is not in the first inference. It lies in the second and third. The second inference assumes the effect will remain stable. The third assumes the cost will remain manageable. Tolerance undermines the first assumption. Dependence undermines the second. From a learning perspective, early relief is a powerful teacher. The moment relief arrives, cues in the environment bind to the change in state. Rooms, times of day, bodily sensations, certain faces and voices, each becomes a signal. The next time similar cues appear, craving mobilizes preparation and attention. Across repetitions, learning migrates from conscious choice toward habit. What required a decision begins to occur automatically. When stress is high and bandwidth is low, the automatic wins. In that moment, the higher cortical systems that compare consequences and weigh values are outmatched by subcortical systems trained to deliver rapid relief. No villainy is necessary. No melodrama is required. A system designed to help a person survive the day has been overtrained on a single response. The void is not only effective, it is also interpersonal. Many individuals with addiction histories report detachment from others long before the substance appeared. That detachment may reflect insecure attachment patterns formed in childhood. When caregivers were inconsistent or frightening, the child's best strategy was distance or appeasement. Distance preserves safety, but kills intimacy. Appeasement reduces conflict, but silences needs. In adulthood, these strategies persist. Honest disclosure feels risky. Requests are withheld. Loneliness increases. Substances and compulsive behaviors offer predictable comfort without negotiation. A reliable mood shift replaces unreliable relationships. The price is cumulative. Over months and years, the capacity for closeness atrophies. The void grows, and the thing that once compensated for the void becomes the reason it endures. Traumatic stress adds another layer. Traumatic experiences, assault, war, systemic violence, sudden loss, chronic humiliation, leave enduring imprints on arousal, memory, and emotion. Hypervigilance becomes ordinary. Sleep fragments. Startle responses remain high. Dissociation provides escape when nothing else works. Substances that dampen arousal feel like first aid. Stimulants that produce focused engagement feel like armor. The short-term logic is impeccable. The long-term cost is that the nervous system never learns to downshift without chemical help, and the cues linked to trauma become paired with cues linked to relief. In that pairing, nightmares, anniversaries, or arguments can trigger not merely fear, but an automatic reach for the substance that once interrupted fear. The person is not choosing. A relapse in the simple sense. A web of learned associations fires faster than evaluation can keep pace. A frequent companion of addiction is difficulty identifying and describing feelings. Alexithymia, the absence of words for emotion, does not mean absence of emotion. It means that signals arrive without labeling or context. The body says something is wrong. The mind cannot specify what. The learned response supplies relief, without vocabulary or plan. Over time, this discourages the development of emotional literacy. Treatment that ignores this gap fails, predictably. Without a language to notice and communicate discomfort, escalation occurs silently until action is all that remains. Building vocabulary for emotion is not cosmetic. It is infrastructure. When people can say, "This is fear, this is shame, this is grief, this is anger," options multiply. Shame invites secrecy. Grief invites support. Anger invites boundary. Fear invites planning. Without naming, all become reasons to use. Co-occurring mental health conditions are common and often precede the addiction. Depressive disorders bring low energy, low hope, and anhedonia. Anxiety disorders bring panic, avoidance, and physiological arousal. Post-traumatic stress disrupts sleep and startles the system. Attention deficit syndromes impair planning and impulse control. Personality traits such as high novelty seeking or high neuroticism increase exposure to risk or magnify distress. When these factors are present, a substance that provides immediate relief functions like a key that finally fits a lock. Once opened, the door is used often. Treating the addiction in isolation while leaving the door jammed ensures repeated return to the only available key. Guilt and shame play distinct roles. Guilt arises from specific actions and can motivate repair. Shame collapses identity into condemnation and motivates hiding. Addiction grows in the shadows shame creates. People who believe themselves irredeemable regard further harm as inevitable and see help as an undeserved gift. Treatment models that amplify shame for motivational purposes may produce short-term compliance, but long-term disengagement. Durable change requires accountability without humiliation, responsibility without contempt. Families and institutions that learn to separate behavior from identity, firm on boundaries, consistent in respect, reduce the fuel on which shame burns. The social field can either reinforce the void or begin to fill it. Poverty, unstable housing, unsafe neighborhoods, and lack of access to healthcare keep stress high and choices narrow. Isolation increases rumination and reduces constructive feedback. Conversely, stable housing, safe relationships, and accessible care expand options. Belonging to a group where sobriety or reduced use is normal changes expectations. Employment that does not punish early disclosure of relapse risk increases the chance of preemptive help seeking. Public policy thus becomes psychological intervention by indirect means. A society that reduces constant threat makes substances less essential as emergency tools. The notion that the higher brain is disabled by addiction oversimplifies what occurs, but points toward an important dynamic. Executive functions, planning, inhibitory control, working memory, decision-making, are finite resources. Chronic stress, sleep deprivation, pain, and hunger reduce those resources. Every crisis withdraws from the same account that must fund resistance to craving. When that account is near empty, previously learned routines come forward. In daily life, this looks like good intentions in the morning and broken promises at night. Restoration, therefore, requires not only saying no to substances, but saying no to avoidable drains on attention and will. Rested bodies and predictable routines are not luxuries. They are prerequisites for self-control. The paradox of relief turning to bondage appears in several mechanisms at once. The reward system adapts so that baseline mood declines while the gap between intoxication and normal shrinks. The person feels worse when sober and less relieved when using. Social networks tighten around the addiction and loosen elsewhere. Opportunities for alternative rewards decline. Self-efficacy declines as broken commitments accumulate. The void originally compensated grows larger. The same behavior intended to cover it now deepens it. This feedback loop continues until an arrest, a hospitalization, an ultimatum, or an internal recognition interrupts momentum. Change begins in many ways: a medical event, a child's comment, an employer's boundary, a legal consequence, a personal reckoning. Regardless of the trigger, early change unfolds along similar lines. Ambivalence dominates. Part of the mind wants relief at any cost. Another part wants stability at any cost. Attempts to override ambivalence with pressure create superficial compliance and covert resistance. Motivational approaches work better. Clarify values, explore discrepancies, and respect autonomy while highlighting consequences. When a person articulates reasons for change in personal terms, health, relationships, work, motivation holds longer than when reasons are imported from authority figures. Psychological treatment functions as a series of practical lessons. First comes accurate mapping. Identify triggers, internal and external, in ordinary language. Identify the earliest moment at which a different choice is still possible. Identify replacement actions that can be executed under stress. Mapping must be precise. Stress is not precise. After conflict at work, agitation rises. On the drive home, the first urge arrives when the turn toward the old neighborhood appears is precise. That level of resolution allows planning. Plans that rely on ideal conditions fail. Plans that assume fatigue and frustration succeed more often. Next comes rehearsal. Replacement actions must be practiced before they are urgent. If walking continues to be the alternative to drinking, shoes must be placed by the door the night before, a route chosen, and a call list prepared in case the walk stalls. If contacting a peer is the alternative to gambling, numbers must be stored and scripts prepared for the first sentence. Rehearsal reduces friction. In the moment of craving, friction decides outcomes. Cognitive work addresses distortions that keep the cycle running. Catastrophizing, a slip equals failure, black and white thinking, either perfect or pointless, and personalization, others can recover, this one cannot, undermine effort. Replacement thoughts do not require cheerfulness. They require accuracy. A slip is data about a trigger that was underestimated. Effort resumes with that information is accurate. Partial progress is still progress is accurate. Accuracy protects persistence. Emotion regulation is central. Many individuals with addiction histories have not learned safe, repeatable methods to downshift arousal. Techniques borrowed from dialectical behavior therapy, paced breathing, temperature shifts, brief intense exercise, grounding exercises, provide non-chemical means to alter state. Mindfulness practices reduce the grip of intrusive thoughts by training attention to observe rather than obey. These are not slogans. They are drills. Drills must be brief, specific, and practiced daily to be available under pressure. Trauma-focused therapies address the events that made substances necessary. When memories remain unprocessed, the body treats reminders as present threats. Exposure-based methods and other evidence-based approaches can reduce reactivity so that ordinary stressors do not feel catastrophic. Somatic approaches help restore a sense of bodily safety. The choice of method matters less than the presence of a trustworthy alliance with a practitioner who understands both addiction and trauma. Without that alliance, people abandon trauma work midway and return to the only reliable relief they know. Shame reduction requires deliberate practice. Disclosure in a safe context reduces secrecy. Language that distinguishes behavior from identity reduces global condemnation. Acts of repair, apologies, restitution, participation in family therapy convert remorse into change. Communities assist by refusing to alternate between idealization and vilification. Consistent expectations and consistent respect produce steadier behavior than intermittent adoration and rage. Family systems need attention. In many households, roles reorganize around addiction. One member becomes the enforcer, another the rescuer, another the scapegoat, another the avoider. These roles maintain short-term stability, but block long-term change. Treatment that involves the family can reassign tasks and teach boundaries. What support looks like, what enabling looks like, what consequences will be applied, and what self-care is required for each member. When family members learn to stop managing another person's use and start managing their own choices, the system stops making the addiction easier to maintain. Boredom is a frequent risk factor, not because boredom is dramatic, but because boredom is an open interval during which old associations have time to assemble. Recovery must include investment in lawful, absorbing activities that produce genuine satisfaction. Work, education, craftsmanship, athletics, service, and art can fill time with structure and purpose. Early in recovery, these may feel flat. That flatness reflects a recalibrating reward system, not evidence that life, without substances, is meaningless. Over months, the capacity to feel interest and pleasure returns. That return is accelerated by regular participation, not by waiting for a spontaneous desire to arise. Sleep, nutrition, and physical activity are not side notes. Exhaustion lowers inhibitory control, poor diet destabilizes mood, and inactivity allows ruminative loops to dominate. Programs that neglect these basics sabotage their own aims. When sleep is stabilized, decisions improve. When meals are regular, irritability declines. When bodies move daily, stress hormones decrease and mood rises. These changes do not solve addiction. They increase the probability that other tools will be used when needed. Workplaces play a role. Policies that offer confidential disclosure, medical leave, and guided return-to-work pathways convert crises into recoveries. Policies that terminate immediately without offering treatment benefits push people further into secrecy and instability. Legal systems face similar choices. Diversion to treatment for eligible individuals reduces repeat offenses and cost. Incarceration for nonviolent substance-related offenses without treatment prolongs cycles and burdens budgets. Public opinion often prefers simple answers. Evidence prefers pragmatic ones. Medication can support psychological change. For opioid and alcohol use disorders, certain medications reduce reward or relieve withdrawal and craving. For comorbid depression or anxiety, appropriate pharmacotherapy can reduce the burden that otherwise drives relapse. The goal is not replacement euphoria, but stable platform. Stability allows practice. Practice builds confidence. Confidence raises the threshold at which old routines activate. Debates that reduce medication to moral commentary ignore outcomes that matter: mortality, employment, parenting, and criminal justice involvement. Contingency management leverages basic learning principles by rewarding target behaviors with immediate, tangible reinforcement. Attendance, negative toxicology screens, and treatment milestones can be paired with vouchers or other benefits. Critics worry about paying individuals to do what they should do anyway. The counterargument is not philosophical, it is empirical. Programs that apply contingent rewards see higher retention and better outcomes. The brain values immediacy. Recovery uses that fact rather than fighting it. Spiritual and existential questions arise as the void is addressed directly. The removal of a central habit exposes questions that the habit had answered by default. What matters enough to organize a day? Who counts as a reliable ally? What behaviors belong to the person one wishes to become? Some answer within religious traditions. Others answer through secular commitments to service, art, family, or craft. The content is less important than the function, a durable source of meaning that does not punish the body or the mind. Without a replacement center, the orbit remains unstable. Lapse management prevents a slip from becoming a reversal. Planning acknowledges that perfect control is rare, particularly in the first year. The plan specifies whom to contact, what to disclose, and what steps to resume immediately. Secrecy converts lapse into relapse. Transparency converts lapse into information. Organizations contribute by removing zero-tolerance rules that drive people underground and replacing them with structured responses that include accountability and rapid re-engagement. Long-term recovery is less about peak moments and more about reliable maintenance. Checkups replace crises. Peer contact continues after formal treatment ends. Families maintain boundaries consistently rather than dramatically. Employers and courts measure success by months and years, not weeks. The person at the center of this system internalizes basic habits. Answer the phone, attend the appointment, keep the structure even when mood argues against it, repair quickly when harm occurs. Over many months, the void that once seemed permanent shrinks. It is replaced not by constant joy, but by competence and connection. That replacement is sufficient. Differences across populations deserve attention. Women often carry higher burdens of caregiving and trauma exposure and face gendered stigma that delays help seeking. Men face cultural norms that discourage vulnerability and push toward risk behaviors. Adolescents and young adults have developing brains with heightened sensitivity to reward and peer influence, making early intervention critical. Older adults may present with late-onset problems driven by isolation, pain, and loss. Culturally responsive care acknowledges different histories, beliefs, and family structures and adapts approaches accordingly. A single script cannot serve every group equally well. Technology has altered access to substances and behaviors. Online gambling, round-the-clock markets, and algorithmic nudges reduce friction between impulse and action. At the same time, technology enables telehealth, digital peer groups, and early warning tools for relapse risk. The same infrastructure that can accelerate harm can be used to accelerate help. Implementation is a policy decision, not a technical inevitability. Measurement matters. Programs that track retention, mortality, employment, housing stability, family reunification, and patient-reported quality of life are accountable to realities rather than rhetoric. Funding should follow outcomes, not slogans. Communities that require public dashboards for treatment systems build trust and learn faster. Those that focus on symbolic victories accumulate press releases, but little change. The end state of effective psychological work is not a person who never feels distress. It is a person who can recognize distress early, label it accurately, communicate it to others, and choose among practiced responses that do not add new harm. The void is not annihilated. It is acknowledged and managed. Memory does not erase adverse experiences. It integrates them without constant reactivation. Craving does not disappear entirely. It becomes a signal that cues a prearranged plan. This picture is modest by design. Grand promises often break. Modest aims can be met and sustained. A society that takes addiction seriously adopts the same stance. The goal is not a population without appetite or error. The goal is a population with access to accurate information, stabilizing resources, timely care, and pathways back from mistakes. In such a society, the psychology of addiction is not romanticized, minimized, or exploited. It is understood, planned for, and addressed with honest tools. That approach honors the severity of the subject without dissolving it into story and spectacle. It replaces improvisation with design and blame with work. Under those conditions, the search for relief does not end. It changes direction. Relief is still sought, but now sought from sources that leave dignity intact and life intact as well.